the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined, as always, by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, I thought we'd start this week's podcast talking about the shifting sands in the Middle East. And what do I mean by that? The other day, there was this photo that came out of Amicham Norkin, General Norkin, the head of the Israeli Air Force, in Dubai for the expo. And on the sidelines of the expo, there's a meeting of air chiefs from around the world. He was there. And one of the photos that came out was him chatting with his German counterpart, his Emirati counterpart, who we saw for the first time in Israel a couple weeks ago during this international blue flag exercise that the Emiratis were here for. And that was interesting back then. But also standing next to him, chatting with smiles on their faces, was a commander in the Jordanian Air Force. That's something you never really see. And it comes on the heels of a picture that came out last week of Israeli generals, brigadier generals in Egypt, in Sharm, in the Sinai, meeting with a member of the multinational observer force that's been in the Sinai since the end of the Yom Kippur War back in, I think, probably starting 1974, and Egyptian soldiers. Again, another image you never really see, Israeli soldiers standing alongside Egyptian soldiers. And to make it even more interesting, you got Benny Gantz. Yeah. Going to Morocco next week.
And what's important about that trip also is that he plans to sign a memorandum of understanding with the Moroccans about national security, which is also something unprecedented.
Right. And let's just remember who Benny Gantz is just for one second. He's not just the defense minister. He's the former chief of staff of the IDF. He's the man who oversaw operations in the Gaza Strip. He's the person who the Palestinians would like to see tried at the ICC in The Hague. Right. So what's happening here is in my view, in my eyes, just in these past 2 weeks, fascinating, right? I mean, obviously the Abraham Accords are behind all this, and you know, we've been speaking a lot about it, but this openness now of the Jordanians, of the Egyptians, of the Moroccans to host an Israeli defense minister openly, journalists are invited to travel with him, is something that I don't think we've ever really experienced here. And it's worth, you know, pausing to I don't know, celebrate the moment, but to really understand how significant this is.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. I think this is what the Abraham Accords were about, right? When they were first signed, there were some people who were doubters, you know, about, okay, well, this is nice, but is it really a big deal? And I think it is a big deal. I think that it's just really going to reshape the Middle East. It's going to increase our stability. Like, does it take away the Palestinian problem? No. But it's just a huge sea change in the region. And to have that to sort of support from your neighbors is, you know, it's just something else. It's just a different environment for Israel.
Interesting. I think so, too. And it shows what's possible. And I think it's also interesting that all of this is happening as there's all these meetings right now that you've been writing about. And Tova Lazaroff from the Jerusalem Post has also been writing about these so-called donors meetings, right? There was the meeting of the UNRWA, and now the UN trying to raise money for UNRWA, which is meant to help Palestinian refugees. And now there's all these other countries that are being asked to give money. And to me, Lahav, I got to be honest, and you know my stand on this issue. I think that we have to work harder towards a resolution with the Palestinians that sees a separation, two-state solution if possible, but some sort of separation. So I'm all in favor of beefing up and bolstering the Palestinians. But it also seems to me that we're kind of stuck still in the 90s with all these donors meetings and UNRWA meetings, and the Middle East has changed, and that's what we're seeing. So you're getting these two images of a region. One is how Israel is plowing forward with normalization, with an openness and a publicity of relations never seen before in the history of the Middle East. And at the same time, we're still stuck trying to get countries to give money to the Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, and the whole posture where, like, Israel is trying to get other countries to give money to the Palestinians is a little bit ridiculous, too, right? Like, it's not our job. Like, I get that the Palestinian Authority, when it's stable, it's easier for us security wise. But if the ultimate goal is statehood, like, clearly, like, it's just a money pit that these countries throw more and more money into, and it hasn't gone anywhere. Now, for the Israeli government, officially at this moment, the goal is not necessarily statehood. Certainly for the prime minister, the goal is not statehood, but it just seems like a contradiction, and constantly Israeli governments are just trying to deal with the status quo and not think about the future, right? But we have an Israeli minister, Isawi Fretch, going to this donors conference and asking the world to give the Palestinians more money. And then at the same time, we have Gilad Erdan, our ambassador to the UN, telling countries not to give more money to UNRWA. And it's like, what is our policy here? First of all, why are we asking them for more money and less money at the same time? And what are we asking them for this money for? And it's just this constant, like, I don't know, situation that Israel is in where we don't really know what we want, or as a government, we can never agree on what we want. So, you know, in that way, I don't know, maybe we're not stuck in the 90s, but maybe we're stuck in the early 2000s in those terms.
Well, not having policy when it comes to the Palestinians is not new, right? I think that for definitely the fair part, the majority of the former prime minister Netanyahu's term, it was also just about maintaining the status quo. And this government, what I like to call the kaleidoscope government, came into office. And they recognize from the beginning, we're not going to be able to make any big changes. We don't agree. We have ideological divides, but at least we can keep things at the point that they were at, right? Not make it worse, but probably not make it dramatically better, except for economic prosperity, maybe. But the lack of policy is a long-term Israeli plague, if I could call it that, of not knowing what we want, right? And not just deciding what do we want, and instead being dragged on by the world to do what they want us to do when it comes to the Palestinians.
Right.
I'm curious, Lahav, at the same time, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the American ambassador to the United Nations, is visiting Israel this week. What's the significance of her visit, if at all there is any?
Well, first of all, you know, in the U.S., the ambassador to the U.N. is considered a member of the cabinet. So that's significant in those terms. I think that it's sort of given a greater significance than we give the ambassador to the U.N., where it here, I think it kind of just depends who's the ambassador in a given government, how he's treated. But yeah, and she's the first member of the cabinet, of Biden's cabinet, to visit this new government. So that's important. As far as who Linda Thomas-Greenfield is personally, you know, this is actually, she is a career diplomat, and this is actually her first visit to Israel. So, you know, Gilad Erdan, our ambassador to the UN, has gone, you know, so out of his way to make this like a special and interesting and enlightening trip for her. Right now, as we're recording this, they are on a helicopter. They visited the Gaza border this morning, and they're on a helicopter now to the Lebanon border. And I know this because Gilad Erdan sent me a selfie not that long ago, because I sent him a question for a story I'm working on, and he said, "I can't talk, selfie on the helicopter." And so, you know, she's getting that sort of security tour.
Helicopters. He can't, yeah. Men in their toys, yes.
Right. Well, I mean, you can't talk on a helicopter, so in that case. But there, you know, so she's getting the full sort of security tour, trying to understand what challenges Israel faces on its borders and the terrorist groups that really, you know, the UN is part of the arena in which Israel pushes back against them, and the US is a big partner in that. Right. So, you know, she's really getting the of course VIP treatment she deserves. This does come after the UN brought up its usual package of annual package of anti-Israel resolutions, and I believe it was seven of them, and the US voted against them 6 out of 7. But on the 7th, which was about UNRWA, which we had already mentioned, the US abstained. Because the U.S. supports UNRWA, but also the resolution included language about the right of return, as in to allow all Palestinian refugees and their descendants, which is like 4 or 5 generations at this point, you know, live in Israel, which would essentially make Israel no longer a Jewish state. But on the other hand, the U.S. supports UNRWA. So they decided to abstain on that one instead of opposing it.
Which was a shift from the prior administration, which had voted
correct
against that.
Well, the prior administration not only didn't fund UNRWA anymore, I mean, yes, the Pirate Administration didn't fund UNRWA anymore. And of course, they opposed the right of return, which, as far as I could tell, this administration does as well. So for them, it was a no-brainer to just oppose it.
Well, in other news, big story this week in Israel is this couple, the Oknin couple, who have been apprehended or detained, arrested, captured, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, media in Israel has been starting to say that they're kidnapped.
Kidnapped. Now they've been kidnapped by the Turks. This is just for our listeners. This is a couple from the city of Modi'in, who had gone on vacation to Istanbul. They were taking a tour. I think they were on a boat, right? And they took a photo
This is interesting. They took the photo. There's a new tower in Istanbul, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name, but it is the tallest tower in Europe because Istanbul is on the Europe side of Turkey. And that's like where they took the picture.
A Greek goddess or something? No, on top of it, maybe?
Towers. Okay. But it's new. It just opened like a few months ago. And they were visiting it and they could see Erdogan's palace. It's not actually his usual residence because he's usually in Ankara, the capital. But anyway, they said, you know, that's Erdogan's palace. It's so beautiful, whatever. They took pictures of it. And some waiter who was up there in the restaurant of the tower overheard them. It's apparently illegal to take pictures of Erdogan's, you know, the leaders' houses, and reported them to the police. And they were arrested around the beginning of last week.
This is probably inappropriate. So probably I shouldn't do it. But people make jokes of all these different things, and someone passed on to me one of these memes or memes or however you say that. And it was that, you know, the waiter came up to them and said, "Where are you from?" And they said, "Modi'in." And the waiter looked at them and said, "What do you mean, Modi'in?" And they said, "Oh, that's intelligence in English." And as a result, they were immediately suspected of being spies. But that's, you know, with all jokes aside, this is a very serious matter because these are two bus drivers, a couple from Modi'in, who were on an innocent tourist trip to Istanbul. Everyone in Israel has said very clearly, these are not spies, right? And in looking at their Facebook profiles, right, that's not how Mossad agents speak and present themselves to the world. Very politicized Facebook profiles, things like that, by at least one of the people. So they're clearly not Mossad agents. They're clearly not Israeli officials. Why is Turkey holding them?
That is kind of the big mystery. I mean, we have had poor relations with Turkey for over a decade at this point. You know, they were deteriorating and then they got really bad after the whole Mavi Marmara incident.
In 2010, that's a long time ago. Right.
Right. And they've never fully recovered. And then again in 2018, when Hamas was rioting at the borders, Turkey once again expelled Israel's ambassador. We haven't had an ambassador back there since then. In fact, that ambassador is now our ambassador to Bahrain, Eitan Naeh. You know, and Erdogan likes to go out of his way to say horrible things about Israel, you know, that we're
anti-Semitic things about Israel.
Yes, that we kill children on purpose and, you know, the blood libel, basically. He harbors Hamas terrorists. So, you know, not a good guy, not a good friend, even though technically we have diplomatic relations with them. But it's not really clear at this moment why he would be trying to provoke Israel in this way. Now, it must be said that so when they were first arrested, after like a day or so, the police was just going to deport them. And then the prosecution in Turkey said, no, we're going to try them for espionage. And that was when people became suspicious. But the process, ever since the prosecution said, no, we're going to actually indict them, has been the normal process. And the media in Turkey is not really talking about this couple. So there's like sort of, at this point, it seems like the foreign ministry's like assessment of this is like, you know, of two minds.
Yeah, I mean, let's also just keep in mind, you're talking about the media in Turkey. It's not exactly a free media. Turkey has
right.
The highest number of journalists who are in jail, over, I think, 115 or so, over 1,000 are facing trials, right? Erdogan is an authoritarian president and runs almost a dictatorship in that country.
But that's almost why the fact that the media is not talking about it is strange, because if he was trying to make a big fuss about this, then it would be in the media. So that's what the foreign ministry is trying to figure out. Like, you know, there's no message yet from Turkey as far as I know, that is saying what they want from us for this, what, you know, what this is about. And so, you know, the farm industry is doing everything they can. They're using the normal channels, but using them a lot. They've sent a senior diplomat to Istanbul to continue trying to negotiate. And so we'll have to see what happens with them. It reminds me a little bit of this case of Na'mais Eschar, which at the beginning of 2020, she was a yoga teacher from Israel who was traveling from India to Israel and had a stopover in Russia. And on the stopover, they either found weed in her suitcase or she says it was planted in her suitcase. Although from her social media, it seems like maybe she is someone who partakes in weed. Either way.
She smokes but does not inhale.
Right, exactly. Either way, she was in jail in Russia for months, and then Israel negotiated, and Netanyahu himself
flew and picked her up. It was beautiful,
right? I was on that flight because it was in Washington to hear about Trump's peace plan, and then he made a stop in Moscow on the way home to bring Na'mais Eschar home. If I remember correctly, we still don't know what exactly Israel gave Putin or whoever to get Na'mais Eschar out of jail.
Maybe the weed that was confiscated from her.
yeah. So we don't really know what happened there. There were all kinds of theories, but none of them came to fruition. Right. So it'll be interesting to see how this story ends up.
Well, the chances, I think the likelihood of Bennett getting on a plane and flying to Turkey to pick these people up is not going to be that high, right? The ties with Ankara are tenuous at best.
Right.
And, you know, they're going to have to try to find some quiet resolution.
Before we move to the next thing, though, I want to say that there are a lot of Israelis still going on vacation to Turkey, which I find very strange. I mean, for me, for many years now, I've felt like it's just not a safe place to be. And then there's all these people who go and they say, no, it's safe, it's fine. And even this couple, so there's an Israeli Arab who went on vacation in Turkey, wanted to send a video to someone, whatever. He heard them speaking Hebrew on the street and asked them. And it was on the news last night that there was a video from the exact same day they got arrested, hours before. They said Turkey is safe. They love Israelis here. Well, turns out not.
Well, we hope that they do get released soon. We hope that by the time you're listening to this, this couple from Modin is back home with their families and safe and sound, that Israel is able to resolve this problem with Turkey. Just one last word, Lahav, as we're speaking also, the former Prime Minister Netanyahu made a rare appearance in court for the opening of what was supposed to be the testimony of his former aide, Nir Chayfetz. That trial is moving forward, right? The testimony was postponed because of new evidence that the defense said that the prosecution not disclosed. Okay, but Chayfetz will eventually provide testimony. Netanyahu is still coming to court.
Well, Netanyahu, they say, came to court in order to intimidate Chayfetz, because it's not like he's in court every day of the trial.
Right. But if anyone thought, my point is that if anyone thought that this trial was behind us, he's no longer prime minister, who cares? This thing is moving forward, right? And I wonder where it's going, right? I wonder if Netanyahu is not going to try in the months ahead until the Attorney General Mandelblit steps down to try to reach a plea deal with him, take it, go home, make millions, be remembered for being a great prime minister for the state of Israel, as opposed to seeing this trial through and potentially getting convicted.
I do think that it depends who the next, you know, the government is now looking, it's now appointed the committee to find the next attorney general. And I wonder, and I would assume that Netanyahu is watching that closely, because maybe the next person will be someone who will give him like a better plea deal. You know, that surely is a factor.
It surely is a factor, although that's also what's a factor is that Mandelblit's legacy depends on the conviction or acquittal of Netanyahu, even though it'll be years after he leaves office. But everyone will remember it was his decision to indict him. The next man or woman who takes this job, it's not going to be their legacy because it wasn't their decision to begin with. This trial has already begun. They're going to be working on other cases. So I just don't know how much personal capital the next attorney general is going to put into this trial, but we'll have to wait to see what happens. But it is a stark reminder that this trial is moving forward. Netanyahu is still there, still powerful, still intimidating, and Israeli politics are crazy as ever. With that, we have a great interview that Lahav and I did with Israel's ambassador to the United Kingdom, Tzipi Chotoveli. Some of you might remember that last week, Tzipi Chotoveli was, I guess, assaulted is probably the good word, or accosted outside.
It was an attempted assault. Thank God she was fine.
Outside the London School of Economics, she had gone there to give a lecture. The lecture went okay. Lahav wrote about it. You can find the article on our website. But lecture went okay. But then as she left, there was a massive demonstration. She had to be whisked away by her security into a car. There's videos of it online inside Lahav's story on the Jerusalem Post website. But a great interview with Ambassador Chotoveli about what it's like being in London, what that incident was like for her, and Israeli-British relations. Here we go.
This week, our guest is Ambassador to the United Kingdom, Tzipi Chotoveli, former minister and Knesset member from Likud as well, here to talk to us about UK-Israel relations. But we're going to start with an unfortunate incident last week in which Ambassador Chotoveli was attacked, narrowly avoided attack, coming out of a debate on the London School of Economics campus. Could you tell us what happened as you saw it?
Well, before we will speak about what happened after the lecture, it's important to mention I was invited by the students of LSE to give a lecture about Israel and being followed by questions and answers. And it was an hour and a half of event with no disruptions, very respectful event hosted by one of the professors in LSE. And I even received flowers from the students. So when I walked out of the campus, as everyone saw in the very, very famous video, I was actually holding flowers. So the event inside was absolutely excellent. But there were some people who didn't want the event to happen. And part of them are part of the Palestinian Student Union. And they were protesting against the basic idea of even speaking in campus. And unfortunately, and I think, again, this is something that all ambassadors experienced in the past. The campus is not a place where those kind of things should happen, because universities are all about, you know, exchanging views, about having debate about different things. And definitely not a country like Israel should get this kind of reception. And the amazing thing about the event was the fact that the whole British government, starting from the education secretary and then goes all the way to the foreign secretary and home secretary that gave me a personal phone call, they all were standing and supporting Israel, supporting me as the ambassador. And they said those kind of things are crossing a red line and they shouldn't have happened in our campuses, because they realized this is not about, you know, just criticizing certain policy. This is really using violence and bullying in order to silence a legitimate voice. And I think this message created a very, very good buzz around Israel. I gave interviews to the main newspapers here, and I was interviewed in different places. And it looked like the public support around it was so positive, because they realize that those people are not representing British values.
Ambassador Chotoveli, it's also a phenomenon that's not new, right? What's happening in the UK, and we see this also on college campuses in the United States, of course, there's a radical turn to the left, and there is an extreme response often to speakers who come and talk about Israel, definitely pro-Israel speakers. You come from the political right in Israel. I'm guessing that you weren't overly surprised with this type of response.
It has nothing to do to right or left. Ron Porsor was a well-known diplomat, and he received everywhere this kind of reception. Mark Regev, my predecessor, had the same kind of incidents on different campuses. Mm-hmm. So it's really not about my political affiliation from the past. It's really about some people trying to label Israel, trying to silence the representatives of Israel. And the most important thing to understand is they don't represent British mainstream. Those people are minority. their vocal, but BDS as a movement fell dramatically because the exchange between Israel and the UK is, it's still our third trade partner, and you can see investment. You can see Israel here is very popular for its leadership in technology. We heard Prime Minister Boris Johnson just last week in COP26 saying to the Israeli Prime Minister Bennett, he said, we should adopt the Israeli spirit. We should move forward with the trade deal. So the vibe here is very positive towards Israel. Some people are getting the image, and I think it's a wrong image, and this is why I think it's important to speak with you, that this is Britain. Well, this is not Britain. This is not UK-Israel relations. Actually, I think from government to government and people to people, we're in a very good momentum.
So let's talk about that positive momentum, because I do think, leaving aside Prime Minister Johnson's sort of personality, which is sort of, I would say, fun in a way. He likes to make things sort of fun and lighthearted, but he seemed very, very positive about Bennett. We know they text each other regularly on WhatsApp, and so they were very happy to meet one another in person. And he did talk about what you said, the Israeli spirit. And it seems that Johnson has been very interested in Israel's COVID response. And I know you told me even a while ago when I interviewed you for the Jerusalem Post magazine that that has become a huge sort of center of UK-Israel relations lately. So where do things stand with that?
I mean, I'll just add that it was Johnson who said after meeting with Bennett, I think it was a CNN interview with, I might be wrong, but Christiana Manpour, who said that he wants to use Israel's model of the booster for the UK model when rolling out their own third shot.
Yes. This is true. Israel was a role model here on all the vaccination rollout. And actually, during the pandemic, even though on a personal level it was very difficult and challenging, on a diplomatic level, it was really a great time for Israel because Ohad is here, our spokesperson, is gonna tell you that the spokesperson of the Israeli embassy didn't get that amount of positive media for a long while. I used to open the newspaper, I just used to see a very, very good headlines about Israel's vaccination rollout, and we became vaccination nation. And I think today, because Israel was the first country to do the booster, and now the Brits are now very much into the booster, and they want to cover as many people possible in the third jab. They're mentioning Israel, and they're taking our data, and they're checking with our experts, the medical experts, how we're doing with with the rates of people being with the virus now. So I would say that health was a big issue here, but we're just in the beginning of the cooperation, because one of the things you realize when you're in the UK, that the British people are very proud in their NHS, in their governmental health program that is really amazing, because it gives service to every person, no matter whether he has insurance or not. It's very different.
Similar to the Israeli Kupat Cholim system, to an extent, right?
Not quite exactly the same, because the thing is, you really can come from everywhere and just, walk into the hospital and get a free access. And I experienced myself when my daughter was sick and we went to a British hospital and I didn't have to use any, health insurance. So it is an amazing thing, but one of the things you are find out that this amazing enterprise, British enterprise, is not digital. So they're quite amazed from those little plastic cards we have that can give medical data from one place to another. And one of the biggest cooperations that the health secretary wants to have with the Israeli experts, and of course with on a grassroots level, is to digitize the British health system. And we would love to do this cooperation because, again, we both share a very, very advanced health systems, and we would like to share practices about this saving life issue. This is a saving life issue.
Ambassador Chotovelli, I have to ask, when you were appointed to the job, right, there were a lot of people who said, and I want to go back for a moment to politics, there were a lot of people who said that your background and your right-wing political leanings might impair your ability to really build relations in the UK. I've heard recently from a number of officials in London, also from the Jewish community, that that's not the case at all, that They've said that you're doing a fantastic job and that you're someone who they can work together, that politics don't get in the way. There was another report, after the new government was sworn in June, that Yair Lapid wanted to replace you. And recently, Yair Lapid, Israel's foreign minister, made comments that that's not the case at all, and very positive comments about you even before the LSE incident. So I'm curious, being ambassador, has that changed anything politically for you? Has it made your own political leanings change? Or is it that one, politics are one thing and being an ambassador is another thing?
I think politics is one thing and being an ambassador is a totally different thing. And of course, I come with my personality. I'm very proud to be the first female ambassador. I bring that to the table. I bring the fact I'm representing a young generation in Israel. I'm bringing many ingredients in my personality, even the fact that I'm an Orthodox woman, that some people in the Jewish community really are happy to have this kind of refreshment in the representative. So I'm bringing many ingredients in my personality to the job. But one thing I need to make clear, and maybe this is something people in Israel don't get, but when people are from the diplomatic community, of course, they understand. There are totally different issues you deal with when you are a diplomat representing Israel when you are politicians, when you are a politician in Israel, because the domestic issues are totally different than the ones we deal with them with foreign government. Let me give you an example. The three top issues I was dealing with were Iran, which again, there is no change of policy. All Israeli governments and all Israeli officials have the same message to the international community. Iran shouldn't have nuclear weapons. Right. So this is something that I don't need to be a right wing or a left wing. I can just represent the policy of my country that sees Iran as the biggest threat to the region and to the Western civilization, and to do everything we can do in order to address this threat. The second issue was health issue. Can you tell me about left and right, about health issues? I mean, this is a life-saving issue. So I'm very proud that the Israeli flag is behind me and I'm representing this amazing country. I'm a very proud Zionist. Maybe you missed that among all the other things you think about me, but I'm a proud Zionist. I'm a patriot, and I really enjoy the diplomatic work, because this is an opportunity to see Israel. And this is something I experienced actually as a deputy foreign minister. When you see your country from outside as an outsider, like for someone that looks in a perspective, we have a really amazing miracle we created. And we want to share it with our friends in the world. And the UK is definitely one of our best friends. And going again to more issues we deal with. So Britain is now in one of its important historic junctions with having Brexit. Getting Brexit done was Boris Johnson, Prime Minister here, slogan for the election. And now in the post-Brexit time, they want to extend their cooperations with countries like Israel that are like-minded in terms of values. They're very advanced technologically. So right. This is an opportunity. And Liz Truss, that is now the foreign secretary, but when she visited Israel, she was the trade secretary. I was joining her to first visit in Israel. And it was an incredible visit. And she was excited about the Israeli atmosphere, about innovation and technology. And she wanted to put those ingredients in the new trade deal. So all I'm saying is diplomacy and politics bring totally different issues to the table, and the issues sure. representing don't put me in any point where I feel like I can't represent Israel, because I'm very proud to represent my country.
So I'd like to get back to the Iranian issue that you mentioned. Britain is one of the partners of the original Iran deal in 2015, and I think that Prime Minister Bennett's meeting with Prime Minister Johnson a couple of weeks ago was very important, and they focused a lot on that issue. But the U.S. is a source close to Bennett, as we write in the article, said to me today, that Israel's position is sort of incoherent with the rest of the world, that especially the countries that Israel is closest with. So how does that sort of affect relations? How are those discussions with the UK government, where Israel and the UK sort of have opposite views of how to handle the Iranian threat?
First of all, I must say that most of those issues are quite classified, so I'm not sure I can really get into the details. The only thing I can say that in a certain point, we felt like the UK government is much more closer to the Israeli approach than other countries that were part of the JCPOA. And we share the same goal. So I think the only question is, having been in a point where Iran is being leaded by a very, very extreme, even more extreme than what the other regime was, and being leaded by Raisi, the biggest problem at the moment that the Iranians are using the time that the international community doesn't have any agreement on the table to continue and move forward with the nuclear program. And this is something that all the international community is really, really concerned about. So I can't really get you into the room about the conversation because it's very classified, but it is something we need to be concerned, because even people that are supporting the JCPOA plus or all those programs that were leaded by the Biden administration, it's not easy to bring the Iranians back to the table on the JCPOA plus, because not enough incentives to the Iranians to do that. So this is the main concern at the moment.
I'm curious, for years, Israel and the British have had very strong defense ties. We've seen trips, I think even over the past year, of the head of the armed forces in Britain who visited Israel, Air Force cooperation. We know of MI6 Mossad relations, which I'm sure you won't want to talk about, but we know that that's taking place over in recent decades. But one of the things that has always been said to be an obstacle to Israeli-British relations was the traditional British ties with Arab countries. Now, that's changed a lot under the Abraham Accords, with Israel now having very close relations with these countries in the Gulf, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, others that might come in the future. I'm curious how much that, if that's changed at all, the atmosphere of the conversations that you're having with your colleagues in London.
Yes, absolutely. I think it was really something that it's a game changer. And it's not just a game changer, for us with our world, which of course is an amazing thing. Actually, my first meetings were with my my friends from the Arab embassies. That when I came to London, the first thing I asked from my team at the embassy, I said, I want to meet the Abraham Accords ambassadors and also the Egyptian and the Jordanian ambassadors, because we don't replace old friends with new friends. We just extend the circle of peace. And it was really warm meeting. So we just had lately nice dinners in my house with the Emirati ambassador, with the Bahraini ambassador. And we really enjoyed a warm and close, friendship, I think. So it's really big. I think that the British government was very much busy with Brexit. So I think in a certain point, it was quite difficult to draw the attention of the British government to, this dramatic event. But once Brexit was done, we got this, I would say, a very, very big support from the Foreign Office people. And we just launched a new parliamentary group that is the supporters of the Abraham Accords. So British Parliament, we had big events lately. And last Hanukkah, we were doing a candle lighting together with the Abraham Accords ambassadors. So we were all lighting different Hanukkiyot in our places. So all together, I think it does give an impact here in the UK, because just like you said, it's old friends from the Gulf together with old friends from the Middle East with Israel get together and we create something new. And we would like this triangle to be strong. And we think more cooperations can be done around, the British stage. And this is what I'm doing here in London.
So you're talking about sort of British enthusiasm for Israel and support also for the Abraham Accords. But, last month, there was the Conservatives' big conference, and the Conservative Friends of Israel sort of area at the conference seemed like the hot spot, the place to be. I know you spoke there, and it seemed like the entire cabinet came to talk about Israel and to talk to that group. Can you tell me about, where is Israel politically in British politics? Because for a long time, there was this huge issue in the Labour Party, and that seems to have, with a concerted effort, seems to have died down a lot. So the Conservatives are clearly enthusiastic about Israel. But what are things going on sort of politically, say, in the parliament, or things coming up in the parties that we should keep an eye on?
Well, it's a very big question, because British politics is fascinating.
Yes.
And actually, this is where I bring my background in as a politician. I find politics here extremely interesting. Labour Party is going through a big I would say they're trying to create a revolution, but they're trying to create a change. And it's very clear that the leadership of Keir Starmer faces big opposition of people that are, you know, coming from the far left. So I would say that with Labour Party, especially with what the Jewish community experienced during the Corbyn time, there is still, I would say, a reconstruction of the way the party is today. It's definitely not the Blair Party. It's very different, but it's definitely not the Corbyn Party. So I would say that Labour Party is still rebuilding itself after the Corbyn era. And the Jewish community is still a skeptic. Whether, I mean, there are many Jews here that supported Labour historically, and there were very good ties between Labour and Israeli Zionist leadership in the beginning and the establishment of Israel. And it has changed in the last few years. And I think this is...
Have you met with Starmer or whoever their shadow foreign secretary is?
I met both of them, and tomorrow I have an event in Parliament with Labour Friends of Israel. So we definitely try to keep you know, connections with Labour. And what I can tell you is that at the moment, the big issues you know, are not about foreign policy. The big issues in this country are, you know, how, you know, cost of living is going to be changed because of Brexit. Health issues are still around us. COVID is still here. My school, my girl's school was quite becoming empty because of kids getting COVID all the time. So basically, there are many, many domestic issues need to be handled. And I'm not sure how much, you know, Israel as you know, the main issue. It's not the main issue. Like, Middle East issues are not the main issues here, even though British media keeps on, you know, having big discussions about Israel all the time, and especially with the last conflict in Gaza. So I would say that we have a great support here from the British government. We have the leadership of Labour that is trying to change and to uproot anti-Semitism, which is a big issue here. And I think anti-Semitism is a big issue. I think it's something that makes everyone being concerned, not just you know, not just the Jewish community, also on a leadership level, everyone is concerned from the amount of anti-Semite, you know, social media, people being attacked in the streets. During the military operation in Gaza, we had those convoys driving in Finchley Road next to my neighborhood and calling horrible things. Some of them were under criminal investigation. So this issue is very, very dramatic here.
Well, Ambassador Tzipi Chotoveli, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. And we hope you stay safe. And thank you for continuing to represent the State of Israel in the way that you're doing it in London. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please send this to your friends. You can hear us on all podcasting platforms. And we will be back next week.